Debates and Encounters. I'm not a fan of the debate format, certainly not the rigidly structured and timed debate ending in a vote. As an undergraduate, I regularly attended the Thursday evening debates at the Oxford Union, and I heard guest speeches, some of them extremely good, from leading politicians and orators of the day, Michael Foot, Hugh Gaitskell, Robert Kennedy, Edward Heath, Jeremy Thorpe, Harold Macmillan, Orson Welles, Brian Walden. Even Oswald Mosley proved to be a mesmerising speaker, however unpleasant his politics. Some undergraduate speakers, too, were extremely accomplished, for example, Paul Foote, Michael's nephew, who later became a penetrating investigative journalist. But I've become disillusioned with the lawyer-style adversarial format of formal debates. Universities enter debating teams in competitions where the speakers are told on the toss of a coin which side they are to advocate. Good training for lawyers, no doubt, but I find something akin to whoring in young people learning to hone rhetorical skills in the service of an arbitrarily allocated cause in which they don't believe, maybe even advocating the opposite of what they believe. If I am moved by oratory, I want it to be sincerely meant. But wait, does a stage speech by an accomplished actor give the lie to my stricture? Does a rousing Henry V at the breach, or a Mark Antony come to bury Caesar, fail to convince because we're listening to an actor and not the real thing? I'd like to think not. I'd like to think that a great Portia transports herself into the skin of her character so deeply that her quality of mercy speech really feels sincere in a way that a lawyer, advocating a defence in which he doesn't believe, cannot, indeed should not. Lala tells me crying on stage comes easily if you really live your character and embrace her pathos. English law, and I think Scottish and American law too, is founded on the tug-of-war principle. In any disagreement, pay somebody to put the strongest possible case for a proposition, whether they believe it or not, pay somebody else to put the strongest possible case against it, and see which way the tug-of-war moves. That's as opposed to the court of inquiry principle, more characteristic of West European law, which seems to me, in my naivety perhaps, more honest and humane. Let's all sit down together, look at the evidence, and try to work out what really happened here. English and American lawyers speak with unabashed admiration of legendary advocates from the past, so good that they even managed to get, fill in name of obviously guilty party, off. So much the better for the lawyer's reputation if any fool could see that his client was guilty, but the great advocate still managed to win over the jury. I was deeply shocked by a conversation with a bright young American defence lawyer who was exultant because the private detective she'd hired had found evidence that proved beyond any doubt the innocence of her client. "Congratulations," I said. "What would you have done if your detective had found evidence that conclusively proved your client guilty?" "I would have ignored it," was her unabashed reply. "It's up to the prosecution to find their own evidence. I'm not paid to give help to the other side." This was a murder case, and she was blithely happy to contemplate suppressing evidence, thereby letting a murderer go free, perhaps to kill again, rather than lose a tug-of-war with the prosecution lawyer on the other side. How could any decent person fail to be shocked by that story? But I've yet to find a lawyer prepared to condemn it. They've inhaled the our side versus the other side smoke so deeply they don't even notice it anymore. I choke on it. Incidentally, a version of the tug-of-war approach to getting at the truth has been adopted by a school of television interviewers, beginning, in Britain at least, with Robin Day. Only yesterday, as I write, I was in a BBC television studio, waiting for my turn in the hot seat. As it turned out, I was not treated in this way, but in the minutes while I waited, the interviewer was getting through a series of politicians, representatives of all three main political parties, on the topic at hand. His style of questioning was truculent from the outset. The presumption seemed to be that all three of them were lying or at best incompetent. Maybe he believed they were. But I suspect the real reason was his training in a school of journalism which holds that the best way to get at the truth when interviewing somebody is to provoke him as hard as you can in order to see where the tug of war ends up. Perhaps that is indeed the best way, but it's not obviously so, and it needs justifying. Anyway, although I have occasionally accepted invitations to speak at both the Oxford and Cambridge unions, I don't like the adversarial style of debating. My first experience of it was in 1986 at the Oxford Union, when John Maynard Smith and I took on a pair of creationists, Edgar Andrews and A.E. Wilder Smith. The motion was that the doctrine of creation is more valid than the theory of evolution. I certainly wouldn't agree to debate such a motion today, and even in 1986 I did it only to support a valued pupil from New College, Danielle Asif, who had agreed to be the lead undergraduate speaker on the science side. Neither of the two guest speakers on the other side had any qualifications in biology. Wilder Smith, a chemist, turned out to be a harmlessly genial buffoon. Andrews, a physicist and less genial, had written a number of books advocating fundamentalist creationism, including Flood Geology. Yes, that's Noah's Flood, which I took the precaution of reading before the debate. Of course, naive creationism would be an instant debate loser at the Oxford Union, so Andrews pretended to a more sophisticated philosophy of science approach. Nobody would have guessed that he, a professor of physics, could seriously be a naive creationist, until I began reading out passages from his books. Pathetically and repeatedly, he stood up and tried to persuade the president to stop me reading from his own writings. Very properly she overruled him, and he sat with his head in his hands as I read out the significant passages, giving the lie to his philosophical pretensions. At the drinks after the debate, he had an altercation with John Maynard Smith, the only time I ever saw that beloved good man flush red with anger. The more specific reason why I now refuse to take part in formal debates with creationists is that every time a scientist agrees to such a debate, it creates an illusion of equal standing. An audience is fooled by the presence of two chairs side by side on the platform, the allocation of equal time to both sides, fooled into thinking there really are two sides, fooled into thinking there's an issue of real substance to debate. It was Stephen Jay Gould who first opened my eyes to this two chairs effect. I'd been invited to debate with a creationist in America, and I telephoned Steve to ask his opinion. "Don't do it," was his friendly advice. The moment a real scientist agrees to such a debate, the creationist has won his main objective, no matter what actually happens in the debate itself. "They need the publicity," Steve pointed out to me. "You don't." Robert May put the same thought with characteristically blunt Australian wit. When invited to participate in such a debate, his favoured reply is, "That would look great on your CV, not so good on mine." I've told that story so often that quite a few people think the witticism is mine. I wish it were. So powerful is the two chairs effect that it has actually, with petty malice, been turned around and used against me. I was once invited to have a debate in Oxford with an American Christian apologist called Craig, who had been badgering me for years to have a second debate with him. The first was at a big event in Mexico, where he was the least impressive of the three speakers on his side. As it happened, I had another speaking engagement in London on the evening of his proposed Oxford debate, but I would have refused in any case, for reasons I'll mention in a moment. So, his supporters placed an empty chair on the stage in Oxford and pretended I'd been too cowardly to turn up. In his case, I had already published in The Guardian a very particular reason for not wishing to share a platform with this individual ever again, my disgust at his justification of the biblical slaughter of the Canaanites. I wasn't complaining about the alleged massacre itself. Like most of Old Testament history, it never happened. My point was that Craig, believing that it happened, justified it on the grotesquely immoral grounds that the Canaanites were all sinners, so they deserved what was coming to them. Moreover, all they had had to do was hand over their land to the invading Israelis, sick, and their lives would have been spared. I have come to appreciate, as a result of a closer reading of the biblical text, that God's command to Israel was not primarily to exterminate the Canaanites, but to drive them out of the land. It was the land that was, and remains today, paramount in the minds of these ancient Near Eastern peoples. The Canaanite tribal kingdoms which occupied the land were to be destroyed as nation-states, not as individuals. The judgment of God upon these tribal groups, which had become so incredibly debauched by that time, is that they were being divested of their land. Canaan was being given over to Israel, whom God had now brought out of Egypt. If the Canaanite tribes, seeing the armies of Israel, had simply chosen to flee, no one would have been killed at all. So it was the Canaanites' fault. They had it coming to them, because God wanted their land for his pet tribe's Lebensraum, and the incumbents just refused to get up and abandon their homes of their own accord. Craig even justified the slaughter of the children, since they'd go to heaven anyway. In passing, my Guardian article mentioned the empty chair tactic, which had been well publicised in advance. In an epitome of bullying presumption, Craig now proposes to place an empty chair on a stage in Oxford next week to symbolise my absence. The idea of cashing in on another's name by conniving to share a stage with him is hardly new. But what are we to make of this attempt to turn my non-appearance into a self-promotion stunt? In the interest of transparency, I should point out that it isn't only Oxford that won't see me on the night Craig proposes to debate me in absentia. You can also see me not appear in Cambridge, Liverpool, Birmingham, Manchester, Edinburgh, Glasgow, and, if time allows, Bristol. Craig reserved his special sympathy for the poor Israeli soldiers who were obliged to carry out the unpleasant duty of massacring all those Canaanite women and children. The empty chair gambit, by the way, has since become known as Eastwooding, because it was used by the actor and director Clint Eastwood in an inept stunt aimed at President Obama during the 2012 presidential campaign. My two chairs objection to debating doesn't apply to scholarly theologians with real credentials. With them, I'm happy to have debates. I prefer to say public conversations, and I have done so with two archbishops of Canterbury, an archbishop of York, several bishops, a cardinal, and two successive holders of the office of British Chief Rabbi. In most cases, these have been amicable and civilised encounters. Sometime in 1993, for example, at the Royal Society, I was paired with the distinguished cosmologist Sir Herman Bondi against Hugh Montefiore, former Bishop of Birmingham, and Russell Stannard, a Christian physicist and author of the excellent Uncle Albert books, explaining modern physics to children. Stannard has written his own account of the meeting. On being introduced to each other by one of the organisers, Dawkins straight away told me how much he'd enjoyed my Uncle Albert books. He actually enjoyed them. I immediately thought that anyone who enjoyed Uncle Albert couldn't be all that bad, could they? But wait, was this a trick to lull me into a false sense of security? As it turned out, I needn't have worried. The debate was conducted in a constructive and courteous manner. This is not to say that the debate lacked tension, far from it. There were cut-and-thrust exchanges and out-and-out disagreement on various issues. But there was no acrimony, no cheap point-scoring. To underline just how good-humoured the debate had been, the participants adjourned afterwards to a restaurant for a pleasant supper together. I sat next to Dawkins and thoroughly enjoyed his company. I have had four meetings with Rowan Williams, recently retired as Archbishop of Canterbury, and found him to be one of the nicest men I've ever met, almost impossible to argue with, he is so agreeable. And so obligingly intelligent, in the literal sense of intelligo, I understand, that he actually finishes your sentences for you, even when those sentences, in my understanding of them, should have been devastating for his position, and he doesn't seem to have any comeback to them. I first noticed this engaging habit when I interviewed him for one of my Channel 4 documentaries. He later invited Lalla and me to a delightful party in Lambeth Palace. I think Lalla may have been the main draw there, because his son, Pip, was a fan of her character in Doctor Who. Then, a few years later, he and I had a rather over-publicised debate in the Sheldonian Theatre. I wanted this to be a friendly conversation without a chairman, because I find, as I'll explain later, that chairmen often get in the way of the discussion, and so it proved in this case. Afterwards, the Archbishop and I sat together at dinner, and I was again charmed by his company. Our most recent encounter was as speakers on opposite sides in a debate at the Cambridge Union. This was after Dr. Williams had stepped down from the Archbishopric to become Master of Magdalen, and he told me at dinner of his sheer joy on waking every morning and remembering, "I'm not Archbishop of Canterbury anymore." When it came to the debate itself, his side won, and the victory was widely credited to him. He did indeed make a decent speech, but the real victor, as was clear from audience reaction, was the last speaker on his side, the very personable journalist Douglas Murray. Murray proclaimed himself an atheist, but thought, and this was really his only point, that religion was good for people, they'd be unhappy without it. I can't imagine Rowan Williams ever being so patronisingly condescending, but, surprisingly, the Cambridge audience lapped it up. I think the most revealing conversation I've had with a theologian was my filmed interview with the Jesuit Father George Coyne, erstwhile director of the Vatican Observatory. We filmed it for the same Channel 4 television documentary as my interview with Archbishop Williams. Unfortunately, the director felt he couldn't find the time to include both interviews, and he dropped the one with Father Coyne. This professional astronomer, a scientist to his fingertips, talked like an intelligent atheist for most of the interview. God, he said, is not an explanation. If I were seeking for a God of explanation, I'd probably be an atheist. To which my inevitable reply was that that was exactly why I am an atheist. If an all-powerful creator God is really there, how could he not be an explanation for things? Or if he's not the explanation for anything, what exactly does he do with his time that makes him worth worshipping? Father Coyne also cheerfully agreed that his Catholic beliefs flowed from the accidental circumstance of his having been born into a Catholic family, and he accepted that he would have been an equally sincere Muslim if he'd been born into a Muslim family. I was struck by his personal honesty, while at the same time marvelling at the professional dishonesty that his Catholic orders imposed upon him. He impressed me as a decent, humane, intelligent man. As did the British Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who invited Lalla and me to dinner in his house with some of London's leading Jews. It was at that dinner that I learned the stunning fact that Jews, who constitute less than 1% of the world's population, have won more than 20% of all Nobel Prizes. This makes a poignant contrast with the derisorily low success rate of the world's Muslims, who are orders of magnitude more numerous in the world. I thought, still do, the comparison revealing. Whether you think of Judaism and Islam as religions or cultural systems, neither is a race despite widespread misconceptions, how could it not be revealing that one of them has a success rate per head which is literally tens of thousands of times higher than the other in the fields of intellectual endeavour celebrated by Nobel? Islamic scholars were notable in keeping the flame of Greek learning alive during the Middle Ages and Dark Ages of Christendom. What went wrong? Incidentally, Sir Harry Kroto has written to me of his belief that the great majority of Nobel laureates listed as Jews, including himself, are actually non-believers. In a later encounter with Lord Sacks in a television studio in Manchester, rather weirdly he publicly accused me of anti-Semitism. It turned out that the reason for this was my characterization in The God Delusion of the God of the Old Testament as arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. I've quoted the rest of the sentence elsewhere in this book, and I agree that it does sound a bit polemical, although it can be justified in spades from the Bible. But my intention was directed less towards polemic than comedy. I had in the back of my mind Evelyn Waugh's rare purple set pieces, and I glancingly signalled the allusion by recounting in the very same paragraph a story told by Waugh about Randolph Churchill. I couldn't, of course, deny that my sentence was anti-God, but anti-Jewish. It was not, by the way, the first time I was accused of anti-Semitism on similar grounds. I gave a lecture on a ship cruising the Galapagos archipelago, and a fellow passenger objected. His sole reason was that I was against God, whom he apparently identified with his own Jewishness, and as a result, he felt personally offended. The chief rabbi was good enough to send me a gracious apology a few days later, and I take his remark in the studio to have been a temporary aberration, an anomalous mistake by a decent gentleman. I was not, to put it mildly, so impressed by the most senior Roman Catholic spokesman with whom I have debated, Cardinal George Pell, Archbishop of Sydney. We were pitted against each other in a television studio of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. I had been warned in advance that he was a bully and a bruiser, not a happy reputation, you would think, for a senior figure in a church purporting to be founded on more generous principles. Pell played for cheap laughs from the gallery in a way that clerical gentlemen of the stature of Archbishop Williams, Chief Rabbi Sacks, and Father George Coyne would never do. He was fortunate that a substantial fraction of the studio audience had obviously been hand-picked as partisans in his favour, because he had an almost endearing gift for putting his foot in his mouth, as when he spoiled his otherwise praiseworthy acceptance of evolution by adding the gratuitous error that humans were descended from Neanderthals. Or when he told an anecdote about a time when he had been preparing some English boys and allowed an embarrassing pause to ensue before he completed the sentence for First Communion, a pause long enough to allow a minority of the audience to laugh suggestively. A less endearing faux pas was his apparent doubt as to the intelligence of Jews and his puzzlement at God's having chosen them. The chairman, Tony Jones, immediately jumped on that, and the cardinal had to dig frantically to extricate himself. I let him dig, and resisted the temptation to quote the rhymed exchange between W. N. Ewer and Cecil Brown. How odd of God to choose the Jews! but not so odd as those who choose a Jewish God yet spurn the Jews. He drew delighted applause from the partisan majority when he seemed to score a point by quoting Darwin's autobiography in evidence that he was a theist when he wrote it towards the end of his life. This is definitely false, and I said so. Pell, however, was briefed with notes and able to say that he was quoting page 92 of Darwin's memoir. It was this triumphant citation of page 92 that led his claque to applaud. Here's a bit of a digression, but a televised misrepresentation of Darwin's religious belief by a prince of the church is surely important enough to make it necessary. Looking at the autobiography today, I'm inclined to think that Pell was not being deliberately dishonest in his triumphant citation of page 92. Very probably an assistant furnished him with the quote, complete with page number, and failed to tell him what follows it. Judge for yourself. Here is what Pell quoted from Darwin's chapter on religious belief, with the word that I think Pell should have emphasised picked out. Another source of conviction in the existence of God, connected with the reason and not with the feelings, impresses me as having much more weight. This follows from the extreme difficulty, or rather impossibility, of conceiving this immense and wonderful universe, including man with his capacity of looking far backwards and far into futurity, as the result of blind chance or necessity. When thus reflecting, I feel compelled to look to a first cause having an intelligent mind, in some degree analogous to that of man, and I deserve to be called a theist. Pell could argue that the when that begins the sentence did not have the conditional meaning that I see there, but was an absolute statement. The succeeding paragraph, however, which Pell did not read to us, leaves us in no doubt of Darwin's actual position when he wrote the chapter. Once again, I emphasise the key to interpreting his meaning. This conclusion was strong in my mind about the time, as far as I can remember, when I wrote The Origin of Species, and it is since that time that it has very gradually, with many fluctuations, become weaker. The mystery of the beginning of all things is insoluble by us, and I, for one, must be content to remain an agnostic. I think we must exonerate Cardinal Pell of the charge of dishonesty. Let's allow that he, or his assistant, simply didn't read the second paragraph and pardonably misunderstood the first. But I would like to hope that, if my book is seen by any of that Australian audience who cheered him on when he triumphantly said, "It's on page 92, they will take the trouble to read the whole of Darwin's chapter on religious belief in his autobiography. In addition to the paragraph I quoted above, where Darwin concludes that he is content to remain an agnostic, much of the rest of the chapter consists of strong criticism of the Christian faith in which Darwin, as a young man, was a devout believer, destined for a career in the church. There's the famous sentence, for example, where Darwin said he could hardly see how anyone ought to wish Christianity to be true, for if so, the plain language of the text seems to show that the men who do not believe, and this would include my father, brother, and almost all my best friends, will be everlastingly punished, and this is a damnable doctrine. Darwin remained benevolently disposed towards his local parish church, supported it financially, and wished to be buried there, a wish that was denied when his friends succeeded in getting him honoured in Westminster Abbey. And he questioned what he perceived as the militant atheism of Edward Aveling, 1849-98, and his German colleague Ludwig Büchner, 1824-99. Aveling's account of their meeting at Darwin's lunch table in 1881 begins with a moving description of how the visitor fell under the spell of the frankest and the kindliest eyes that ever looked into mine, and then turns to their discussion of religion. Darwin asked, "Why do you call yourselves atheists and say there is no God?" Aveling and Büchner explained that they were atheists because there was no evidence of deity, that whilst we did not commit the folly of God denial, we avoided with equal care the folly of God assertion, that as God was not proven, we were without God, atheoi, and by consequence were with hope in this world and in this world alone. As we spoke, it was evident from the change of light in the eyes that always met ours so frankly that a new conception was arising in his mind. He had imagined until then that we were deniers of God, and he found the order of thought that was ours differing in no essential from his own. For with point after point of our argument he agreed, statement on statement that was made, he endorsed, finally saying, "I am with you in thought, but I should prefer the word agnostic to the word atheist. To this day, there is confusion over the word atheist, some taking it to mean a person who is positively convinced that there is no God, what the atheist Aveling called the folly of God denial, others a person who sees no reason to believe in any God and therefore lives their life in a God-free manner, i.e. what Darwin meant when he called himself an agnostic, and what Aveling meant by without God. Probably rather few scientists would adopt the first sense, although they might add that the loophole they leave for a God is scarcely wider than that through which leprechauns or orbiting teapots or Easter bunnies may jump. There's a spectrum between the two positions, and Darwin would admittedly have been less sceptical of gods than of flying teapots, as we can guess from a conversation with the Duke of Argyle late in his life. By the Duke's account, "I said to Mr. Darwin, with reference to some of his own remarkable works on fertilisation of orchids and upon the earthworms, and various other observations he had made of the wonderful contrivances for certain purposes of nature, I said it was impossible to look at these without seeing that they were the effect of mind. I shall never forget Mr. Darwin's answer. He looked at me very hard and said, 'Well, that often comes with overwhelming force, but at other times,' and he shook his head vaguely, adding, 'it seems to go away.'" I too am marginally less sceptical of gods than of teapots in orbit around the sun, if only because the set of all imaginable things that might qualify as gods is larger than the set of orbiting projectiles that would qualify as teapots. But I think Darwin would agree with Aveling and me that the onus of proof is on the theist. I hope I wasn't unfair in my assessment of Cardinal George Pell. Rather than take my word for it, you could listen to the debate itself. I don't think a recording has survived of my debate with another prelate, the then Archbishop of York, John Habgood, at the Edinburgh Science Festival in 1992. Perhaps it is just as well, as I'm not particularly proud of my performance, despite, or maybe even because of, the verdict of the Observer journalist, which I'll quote in a moment. If Archbishop Pell is regarded as a bully and a bruiser, I fear that may be how I, though physically of slighter build than they usually make bruisers, came over in my treatment of Dr. Habgood. I wouldn't handle the encounter in the same way now. Perhaps I've become more compassionate than I was, but I find I can't now bear hitting someone who's down. 20 years ago, however, I seem to remember that I paxmaned him, repeating several times, and too unforgivingly, a question on what he really believed about the virgin birth, as opposed to what he professionally was expected to believe. And I'm afraid the audience joined in, barracking him with, "Answer the question, answer the question." The Nullifidian's account of the evening seems to bear out my remembered misgivings. Richard Dawkins, well known for his books on evolution, took part in a debate with the Archbishop of York, Dr. John Habgood, on the existence of God at the Edinburgh Science Festival last Easter. The science correspondent of The Observer reported that the withering Richard Dawkins clearly believed that God should be spoken of in the same way as Father Christmas or the Tooth Fairy. He, the correspondent, overheard a gloomy cleric comment on the debate. "That was easy to sum up. Lions 10, Christians 0. The verb to paxman, for the benefit of non-British readers, stems from a notorious interview by the formidable Jeremy Paxman, Britain's most feared television journalist, of the then Home Secretary, Michael Howard. Paxman relentlessly asked Howard the identical question no fewer than 12 times, while the poor man equally persistently evaded answering. I've just listened to the interview again, and I know I would now be incapable of being so ruthless. Even then, I think that with Dr. Habgood, my limit was 3 repetitions of my awkward question about the virgin birth. Jeremy Paxman, by the way, has interviewed me on BBC television on 2 occasions and has chaired an on-stage encounter between me and the then Bishop of Oxford, Dr. Richard Harries. On all 3 occasions, he was warm and sympathetic, and I found him so when I've met him socially, for example, at a summer dinner in his garden, or at the Hay-on-Wye Festival during the week in which I write this, when he joined me as I was having a solitary hotel breakfast. Maybe it's only politicians who have reason to fear him. I treasure the opening words of his interview with a notorious American political propagandist when she was promoting her book in England. "Your publishers gave us Chapter 1, Ann Coulter, and I've read it. Does it get any better?" I earlier referred to the school of pugnacious television journalists founded by Robin Day. Jeremy Paxman is an even more ruthless exponent. I prefer what I call the mutual tutorial technique of interview or public conversation. Mutual tutorials. More agreeable than debates have been on-stage conversations where the aim has been mutual enlightenment rather than scoring victories. I think the phrase mutual tutorial first occurred to me in February 1999 when I shared the stage at Central Hall, Westminster, with the psychologist and linguist Steven Pinker. Billed as a debate sponsored by The Guardian and chaired by their science editor Tim Radford, the event attracted an audience of 2,300, with many turned away outside. It wasn't a debate. There was no motion, nothing to vote on, and we agreed about most things anyway. And, as I said, it paved the way for what I was later to call the mutual tutorial, a genre of on-stage conversation that I'm increasingly pushing as a superior alternative to both the interview and the debate. Tim Radford, as it happened, did a good and unintrusive job. But it was this encounter that suggested to me the idea of the mutual tutorial, without a chairman or host. The chairman interference effect was especially noticeable in the encounter I mentioned before in Oxford's Sheldonian Theatre with the then Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. Dr. Williams and I were all set to have a civilised conversation, and I'd been greatly looking forward to it. But unfortunately, it was continually derailed by the chairman, a distinguished philosopher and very nice man, whose strenuous efforts to clarify matters by injecting philosophical jargon had, as often seems to happen with philosophers, precisely the opposite effect. The large audience attending my London mutual tutorial with Steve Pinker, notwithstanding that mutual, I have to say that I learned more from him than he did from me, attracted the attention of the BBC. Would we like to go on television that evening in their Newsnight programme and reprise our discussion for a wider audience? We would. A little later, I was telephoned by the BBC producer, wanting to be briefed on what to expect. Could you summarise for me the nature of your disagreement with Dr. Pinker? Well, actually, I'm not sure that we have much to offer in the way of disagreements. We seem to agree over most things. Is that a problem? There was a long pause from the other end of the line. No disagreement. No disagreement. Oh, dear. And she promptly cancelled the invitation. Mutually informative conversation, it seems, is not good television. There has to be disagreements. Sparks must fly. If good television means good for ratings, that's depressing. I'd like to hope that she was mistaken and that disagreement is not, in truth, good for ratings, but I can't summon up much conviction. In any case, my own value judgment, as I said in the previous chapter, would place ratings rather low in the scale of what good television ought to mean. Especially for the BBC, which doesn't have to worry about advertising revenue, since it's financed by central government through the licence fee. The Pinker debate that wasn't a debate encouraged me to promote the format in a new series under the auspices of my charitable foundation, the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science, RDFRS. The first one we did was a conversation before a large audience at Stanford University in March 2008, between the theoretical physicist Lawrence Krauss and me. I began by introducing the format to the audience. Well, I suppose I must bear some responsibility for the fact that we don't have a chairman sitting between us. I am trying to pioneer a new method of public conversation. And I went on to expound the mutual tutorial and to explain my objections to chairmen at such events. I acknowledged that it threw a burden on us to keep the conversation going, and I then passed the burden to Lawrence by inviting him to start. He began by reminding me of our first meeting, which had been somewhat less amicable. It was at a conference in New York State in 2006, shortly after publication of The God Delusion. I was fielding questions after my talk. I've had so much practice at this that I seldom find the questions challenging, but this was different. A questioner, not particularly tall, but every inch a confident inch, stood up in the middle of the audience, and his very first sentence rang with an articulate and fluent conviction, which is understandably rare on such public occasions. He roundly, almost aggressively, berated me for being too aggressive and insufficiently conciliatory when arguing with the faithful. I can't remember how I responded, but afterwards we had a drink together, and Lawrence, in more friendly vein, suggested that we should continue our discussion in print. So we did, and the exchange appeared in the pages of Scientific American, as he told that Stanford audience in his opening remarks. Lawrence and I have had several further public discussions since then, and our original disagreement has abated as we've become friends and drawn closer to each other's point of view. And as we have learned from each other, our mutual tutorials have increasingly deserved the name. Several of these conversations have formed the basis of The Unbelievers, a documentary feature film produced by Gus and Luke Holwerder, showing Lawrence and me in various venues around the world, the most notable being the Sydney Opera House. Lawrence is quirky, funny, and fun. I've never quite known what comic timing means, but I suspect he has it. If he added introspective melancholy to his repertoire, you might call him, as I once did, the Woody Allen of physics. And he's provocative in the best and most constructive sense. Every atom in your body came from a star that exploded, and the atoms in your left hand probably came from a different star than your right hand. Forget Jesus, the stars died so you could be here today. The Unbelievers crew were once filming in a hired limousine on a humid, hot day in London. Almost everything you could imagine was wrong with that car, and Lawrence on the telephone to the company is a treasured memory. Far from introspective, and melancholy comes nowhere near doing justice to his tirade. Climaxing in a threat to wreak physical damage along the whole stretched length of that absurd vehicle. It was a virtuoso performance in exhibition invective, just what we needed to make us laugh in a stifling hot car with both the air conditioning and the window opening mechanism broken. The model for the mutual tutorial pioneered with Pinker and Krauss has proved successful in other public conversations using the same chairman-free format. My partners in these dialogues have included Professor Aubrey Manning and Bishop Richard Holloway, possibly the two nicest men in Scotland. Aubrey and I share a common heritage as students of Nico Tinbergen, Aubrey a decade ahead of me, so our conversation included some reminiscing, with many laughs, about the Athens of Ethology that was the Tinbergen group, but we also talked science itself. Bishop Holloway describes himself as a recovering Christian. He's probably about as close to being an atheist as a bishop can get away with. We've had more than one encounter, including an on-stage conversation in Edinburgh, which moved the Glasgow journalist Muriel Gray to write as follows. Holloway, as we all know, is the church leader who questioned his faith and found it wanting. And Dawkins, of course, is not simply world-famous for his pioneering and award-winning scientific work, but also for his aggressive views concerning organised religion. A couple of audience members before the session began admitted they were worried that the two men might come to blows, or that a fundamentalist audience member might use the event to launch an offensive verbal attack on Dawkins. Instead, the hour that seemed like 5 minutes was one filled with two startlingly intelligent men, each brimming with humanity, drawing personal pictures of just how awesome, mysterious, and wonderful existence is. The sheer joy of hearing Holloway still trying to draw poetry and meaning from a religion he's not quite ready to dismiss completely out of hand, as Dawkins listened eagerly, trying to assist him without dismissing his desires as ignorant, was breathtakingly inspiring. And all this was bookended with Dawkins's views on birthing universes, black holes, and the future of the human species when we start to form ourselves from silicon and alloys instead of vulnerable flesh. Now that's what I call entertainment. However, the most dreadful, in fact utterly unbearable part of the evening was that it stopped after an hour. I think you could safely call that a mutual tutorial. Incidentally, I've since had two intellectually rewarding on-stage conversations also in Edinburgh with Muriel Gray herself. Another wonderful encounter was with Neil deGrasse Tyson, director of the Hayden Planetarium, New York. Our conversation took place in 2010 at a conference organised by the RDFRS on the campus of Howard University in Washington, described as a historically black university. In front of a lively student audience, though a smaller one than both Neil and I are used to, because, as we later learned, religious leaders had discouraged attendance, Neil and I talked of the poetry of science. The phrase immediately makes one think of Carl Sagan, and Neil Tyson has magnificently, but with becoming humility, accepted the challenge of stepping into Sagan's unfillable shoes to present a new version of Cosmos. What a superb spokesman for science he is, this warm, friendly, witty, clever man, whose great knowledge is properly served by his ability to expound it. The only other person I can think of who might have understudied Carl Sagan so well is Caroline Porco, of whom much more in the next chapter. Perhaps it is not entirely surprising that, of all scientific subjects, astronomy should be so well endowed with stellar ambassadors. That was not the first time I'd met Neil Tyson. Our first encounter in San Diego in 2006 was almost a carbon copy of my introduction to Lawrence Krauss. I had just given a talk in which I was critical of the religiously inclined ecologist Joan Roughgarden. At question time, Neil delivered a polite but serious and impeccably phrased attack on my style. "I was in the back row as you spoke, and so I could see sort of the whole room as the words came out of your mouth as beautifully as they always do, and as articulately as they always do. Let me just say your commentary has a sharpness of teeth that I had not even projected for you. Your professor of the public understanding of science, not professor of delivering truth to the public, and these are two different exercises. One of them is you put truth out there, and like you said, they either buy your book or they don't. Well, that's not being an educator, that's just putting it out there. Being an educator is not only getting the truth right, but there's got to be an act of persuasion in there as well. Persuasion isn't always, here's the facts, you're either an idiot or you're not. It's here's the facts, and here is a sensitivity to your state of mind. And it's the facts plus the sensitivity, when convolved together, creates impact. And I worry that your methods, and how articulately barbed you can be, ends up simply being ineffective, when you have much more power of influence than what is currently reflected in your output." I was conscious that the chairman, Roger Bingham, was anxious to wrap up the session, so I replied briefly. "I gratefully accept the rebuke. Just one anecdote to show that I'm not the worst in this thing. A former and highly successful editor of New Scientist magazine, he actually built up New Scientist to great new heights, was asked, 'What is your philosophy at New Scientist?' He said, 'Our philosophy in New Scientist is this. Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.' To the jovial sound of Neil Tyson's bellow of laughter, Roger Bingham closed the session. Neil's critique was a good one. It was pretty much the same as Lawrence Krauss's, although more gently expressed, and it is one that I take to heart. I'll return to the question later, when I come to discuss the God delusion. In some of my mutual tutorials, I have had so much more to learn than my fellow conversationalist that the word mutual needs to be dropped. Most daunting for me was the formidable intellect of Steven Weinberg, Nobel Prize-winning physicist and cultured polymath. I hope I concealed my nervousness adequately, both during our filmed conversation and at the very pleasant dinner party which he hosted for me at his club in Austin, a city I have heard described as an intellectual oasis in Texas. There are some Nobel Prize winners who, you can't help feeling, must have got lucky to pair an American idiom with a little British understatement. You don't get that feeling when you meet Professor Weinberg, and I hope the British understatement is still coming through loud and clear. Good casting for a world-class genius." The chairman free format might seem unlikely to work when more than two discussants are involved, but we managed to make it work well with four of us in the meeting of the so-called Four Horsemen, filmed in 2008 by my foundation in the book-lined Washington apartment of Christopher Hitchens. Dan Dennett and Sam Harris joined Christopher and me, and we got on just fine without a chairman. We had invited Ayaan Hirsi Ali to make a fifth. Unfortunately, she had to dash off on a sudden emergency visit to the Netherlands, where she'd been a Member of Parliament. So we were four after all, and the Horseman title stuck. The hours of discussion around the table passed surprisingly quickly, with no one of us dominating, and I strongly suspect in this case that a chairman would almost certainly have spoiled the atmosphere. Christopher. I need to say something about that hero of the mind, Christopher Hitchens. I didn't know him well. I was not one of his inner circle of friends from youth, but I got to know him when God Is Not Great was published, and its natural bracketing with The God Delusion led to our sharing public platforms of various kinds. I first met him at a debate in London in March 2007 at Central Hall, Westminster, a large venue holding more than 2,000 people, the same venue as for my encounter with Steven Pinker, already mentioned. Christopher and I were teamed with A.C. Grayling, one of my favourite philosophers, to propose the motion, "We'd be better off without religion." It was the promised participation of these two admired colleagues that tempted me to relax my normal objection to formal debates. On the other side were an anthropologist, Nigel Spivey, Roger Scruton, a philosopher, and Rabbi Julia Neuberger, whom I've already mentioned. What I chiefly remember from the debate is a splendid, "How dare you! How dare you!" from Christopher. But it was a false memory on my part, which I should document because false memory syndrome needs to be more widely known, and because I once recounted this false memory in a public speech in Melbourne, eulogising Christopher after his death. I was convinced I remembered Christopher's "How dare you!" as an intervention during Rabbi Neuberger's speech. It wasn't. The videotape clearly shows that it was in response to a questioner from the audience who claimed, because he tried to be a good person, to be religious, although he didn't believe in God. Christopher did intervene during Julia Neuberger's speech, but it was to say something quite different, not clearly audible on the video because his microphone wasn't switched on, but definitely not "How dare you!" False memory syndrome is real, interesting and disturbing. I hope the evidence for it is taught to law students and all those involved in the use of evidence from witnesses, but I fear it is not. Eyewitness evidence is far less reliable than many people think, including jury members. Witnesses in court don't only lie, they're honestly self-deceived. I was first convinced of this when I had the pleasure of meeting Elizabeth Loftus, a brave and personable American psychologist who frequently testifies on behalf of people wrongly accused, for example, of child molestation. In some of the cases she has dealt with, the problem is exacerbated by unscrupulous practitioners deliberately implanting false memories in witnesses, something Elizabeth persuaded me is disquietingly easy to do, especially in children. Nobody went out of their way to implant my false memory about Christopher's intervention. My own brain did it all by itself, subconsciously conflating two real memories. While this book was in press, I happened to meet Professor A.C. Grayling, my fellow debater, at a luncheon. The subject of false memories came up, and I recounted this story to him. To the amazement of both of us, he confessed that he had exactly the same false memory. He was incredulous when I told him the true story. But the film evidence is unequivocal. Both of us had concocted the same false memory. I wonder how often that happens. To me it seems to undermine eyewitness testimony even more gravely than I had thought. Imagine that the incident apparently witnessed was a serious crime instead of an intervention in a debate. Would any jury throw out the identically corroborated, independent evidence of two witnesses, both university professors, if a barrister tried to argue that both witnesses suffered from false memory syndrome? I should apologise for my false memory, but at least I'm in good company. In 1982, the Nobel Prize-winning molecular biologist François Jacob wrote an excellent book called The Possible and the Actual. I read the English translation around the time it came out and came to a paragraph that seemed oddly familiar. I searched and found the reason. Jacob must have read The Selfish Gene, perhaps in the French translation, perhaps he had a photographic memory, or perhaps he copied out a paragraph which he later found and falsely remembered composing it himself. Here are the two paragraphs now. From The Selfish Gene, 1976. Another branch, now known as animals, discovered how to exploit the chemical labours of the plants, either by eating them or by eating other animals. Both main branches of survival machines evolved more and more ingenious tricks to increase their efficiency in their various ways of life, and new ways of life were continually being opened up. Sub-branches and sub-sub-branches evolved, each one excelling in a particular, specialised way of making a living, in the sea, on the ground, in the air, underground, up trees, inside other living bodies. This sub-branching has given rise to the immense diversity of animals and plants which so impresses us today. From The Possible and the Actual by François Jacob, 1982. Another branch called animals became able to use the biochemical capacity of the plants, either directly by eating them or indirectly by eating other animals that eat plants. Both branches found ever new ways of living under ever diversified environmental conditions. Sub-branches appeared and sub-sub-branches, each one becoming able to live in a particular environment, in the sea, on the land, in the air, in the polar regions, in hot springs, inside other organisms, etc. This progressive ramification over billions of years has generated the tremendous diversity and adaptation that baffle us in the living world of today. I don't for a moment think this is wanton plagiarism. Why ever would a distinguished Nobel laureate need to do that? I think it is a genuine case of a failure of memory, or maybe too good a memory for the text itself, and a failure to remember its provenance. Returning to the London debate, it was run by an outfit called Intelligence Squared, whose practice it is to hold a vote both before and after the debate, to see whether the speeches changed anybody's mind. In the case of our debate on the motion, "We'd be better off without religion," our side won the vote before the debate, and afterwards the margin of our success went up from 145 to 427. At dinner, after the debate, I sat opposite Roger Scruton, whom I hadn't met before, and found him quietly charming. We were joined by Martin Amis, among others, and it was lovely to see Martin and Christopher in a witty mock dispute over which one had been the bigger fan of Lala, who sat between them in her Doctor Who role. I think I was probably the last person to interview Christopher Hitchens formally. I had been invited to guest edit New Statesman's Christmas double issue for 2011, and among the pieces I included was an abridged transcript of my own long interview with Christopher. It took place on the 7th of October 2011 in Houston, Texas, where he was receiving advanced treatment for his cancer. He and his wife had been lent a large and beautiful house while the owners were abroad, and it was there that they entertained me to dinner, together with the charismatic writer and filmmaker, who also happens to be Darwin's great-grandson, Matthew Chapman. Christopher was a wonderful host at table, witty, charming and solicitous, although too ill to eat. Before dinner, Christopher and I sat at a garden table and talked for the benefit of New Statesman. I was so terrified of missing anything he said that I used no fewer than three recording devices. They all worked, and my account of the interview can be read in the E-Appendix. Here, I'll just pick out one brief exchange because it meant a great deal to me and still consoles me when I occasionally feel beleaguered. R.D. One of my main beefs with religion is the way they label children as a Catholic child or a Muslim child. I've become a bit of a bore about it. C.H. You must never be afraid of that charge any more than stridency. R.D. I will remember that. C.H. If I was strident, it doesn't matter. I was a jobbing hack. I bang my drum. You have a discipline in which you're very distinguished. You've educated a lot of people. Nobody denies that, not even your worst enemies. You see your discipline being attacked and defamed, and attempts made to drive it out. Stridency is the least you should muster. It's the shame of your colleagues that they don't form ranks and say, "Listen, we're going to defend our colleagues from these appalling and obfuscating elements." He reiterated the point in his final column for Free Inquiry, published posthumously and entitled In Defence of Richard Dawkins. The day after the New Statesman interview, Christopher and I were both at the Texas Freethought Convention where, at the banquet in the evening, I was to present him with the Richard Dawkins Award of the Atheist Alliance of America. This annual award has now been given 12 times, starting in 2003 when it went to James Randi, followed in successive years by Anne Druin, Penn and Teller, joint recipients, Julia Sweeney, Daniel Dennett, Ayaan Hirsi-Ali, Bill Maher, Susan Jacoby, Christopher Hitchens, Eugenie Scott, Steven Pinker, and most recently, Rebecca Goldstein. Christopher was too ill to eat the dinner, and he made his entrance at the end to a standing ovation which made me feel quite tearful. I then made a speech, after which Christopher mounted the platform to another standing ovation, and I presented the award. His acceptance speech was a tour de force, made the more powerful by the poignant fact that his splendid voice was fading, along with his life. It was impromptu, but mine was written, and I reproduce here the opening and closing paragraphs in his memory. "Today I am called upon to honour a man whose name will be joined in the history of our movement with those of Bertrand Russell, Robert Ingersoll, Thomas Paine, David Hume. He is a writer and an orator with a matchless style, commanding a vocabulary and a range of literary and historical allusion far wider than anybody I know, and I live in Oxford, his alma mater and mine. He is a reader whose breadth of reading is simultaneously so deep and comprehensive as to deserve the slightly stuffy word learned, except that Christopher is the least stuffy learned person you will ever meet. He is a debater who will kick the stuffing out of a hapless victim, yet he does it with a grace that disarms his opponent while simultaneously eviscerating him. He is emphatically not of the all-too-common school that thinks the winner of a debate is he who shouts loudest. His opponents may shout and shriek, indeed they do, but Hitch doesn't need to shout. Though not a scientist and with no pretensions in that direction, he understands the importance of science in the advancement of our species and the destruction of religion and superstition. One must state it plainly. Religion comes from the period of human prehistory, where nobody, not even the mighty Democritus, who concluded that all matter was made from atoms, had the smallest idea what was going on. It comes from the bawling and fearful infancy of our species, and is a babyish attempt to meet our inescapable demand for knowledge, as well as for comfort, reassurance, and other infantile needs. Today, the least educated of my children knows much more about the natural order than any of the founders of religion. He has inspired and energized and encouraged us. He has us cheering him on almost daily. He's even begotten a new word, the hitch slap. We don't just admire his intellect, we admire his pugnacity, his spirit, his refusal to countenance ignoble compromise, his forthrightness, his indomitable spirit, his brutal honesty. And in the very way he is looking his illness in the eye, he is embodying one part of the case against religion. Leave it to the religious to mule and whimper at the feet of an imaginary deity in their fear of death. Leave it to them to spend their lives in denial of its reality. Hitch is looking it squarely in the eye, not denying it, not giving in to it, but facing up to it squarely and honestly, and with a courage that inspires us all. Before his illness, it was as an erudite author and essayist, a sparkling, devastating speaker, that this valiant horseman led the charge against the follies and lies of religion. Since his illness, he has added another weapon to his armoury, and ours, perhaps the most formidable and powerful weapon of all. His very character has become an outstanding and unmistakable symbol of the honesty and dignity of atheism, as well as of the worth and dignity of the human being when not debased by the infantile babblings of religion. Every day he is demonstrating the falsehood of that most squalid of Christian lies, that there are no atheists in foxholes. Hitch is in a foxhole, and he's dealing with it with a courage, an honesty, and a dignity that any of us would be and should be proud to be able to muster. And in the process, he is showing himself to be even more deserving of our admiration, respect, and love. I was asked to honour Christopher Hitchens today. I need hardly say that he does me the far greater honour by accepting this award in my name. Ladies and gentlemen, comrades, I give you Christopher Hitchens.